Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're tackling someone who's less like a single academic or artist, and maybe more like a force of nature, someone almost designed to shake up how we think about disciplines.
Definitely. I mean, try to picture this. One person who's a distinguished professor teaching high-level English lit and also painting with a style clearly influenced by Andy Warhol and writing this really experimental poetry using a method he actually calls trance writing.
It sounds impossible, but that's Wayne Kostenbaum, born 1958. He's this incredibly prolific intellectual, and his whole career seems built on just refusing to accept those neat little boxes between art forms.
Yeah, absolutely. So what we've done is pull together everything we could find, academic papers, biographical details, you know, the usual suspects to give you a kind of shortcut, a way into understanding this really unique, sometimes pretty complex cultural critic.
And our goal here, our mission, if you like, is to quickly synthesize, well, maybe not quickly, but synthesize his, 20-plus books, his academic work, his art, and really focus on that key idea about his work.
The idea being how he just, quote, obliterates any vestigial divide between play and thought. That's a great line someone wrote about him.
It really is. And he does it across every single genre he touches. And look, if you need proof that this genre obliteration isn't just him being provocative for the sake of it, but that it's actually seen as profoundly significant, well, you just have to look at the recognition he's received. Like the American Academy of Arts and Letters Award in Literature he got in 2020.
Yeah.
That's a huge deal.
It absolutely is. And that award, it signals more than just, you know, a single achievement.
Yeah.
It points to his endurance, his actual cultural impact over time. You really can't pigeonhole his work easily.
Yep.
And yet these major institutions, the ones dedicated to sort of preserving serious literature, they recognize him as, well, essential.
That's the paradox, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. He operates right at that intersection of like high theory, serious academic thought, but also camp and the deeply personal. It's that mix, that synthesis that we're going to try and unpack today.
Okay, so where do we start? Maybe with the foundations, because you need that grounding to understand how he gets away with being so spectacularly unconventional later.
Exactly. You need the establishment credentials before you can properly dismantle the establishment, right?
Right. So let's unpack that foundation.
Yeah.
If you look at his origins, the commitment to intellectual rigor, it's really clear from the start.
Yeah.
Kostenbaum, born and raised in San Jose, California. But his family life, it sounds like it was just steeped in writing and philosophy.
Oh, completely. This wasn't just like a casual hobby in the house. His mother, Phyllis Kostenbaum, she was a respected writer herself.
Uh-huh.
And his father, Peter Kostenbaum, was a leadership consultant, but also a philosopher. So you've got this blend right there in the household.
Mm, the creative internal focus of writing.
Yeah. And then the more structured, outward-facing analysis of philosophical thinking and consulting, it feels like that environment set a baseline where, you know, the subjective, the personal, and the really rigorous could always coexist. It wasn't an either thing.
That makes sense. And his academic path, I mean, it just confirms he started out as a very serious, you could say, traditional scholar.
Totally. He did the whole academic trifecta, as you called it earlier, a BA from Harvard.
Right.
Then an MA from the Johns Hopkins Writing Seminars, which is known for being incredibly focused on the actual craft, the mechanics of writing.
Okay, so deep into the practice.
Deep into practice. And then finally, the PhD from Princeton. So, you know, top tier institutions all the way.
And this context is really important, isn't it? Because he wasn't just, say, a poet who sometimes write criticism, or a critic who dabbled in poetry.
Exactly. He trained at the absolute highest level in both fields, the academic side, literary theory, and the practical craft of writing. And it's this deep theoretical grounding, I think, that gives his later, sometimes more delirious claims their actual weight.
Because he knows the rules he's breaking.
Precisely. He knows the game inside out, which is why he's so effective when he decides to subvert it. And we should also mention the Whiting Award he got back in 1994.
Ah, yes, for emerging writers.
Yeah, which recognizes writers with exceptional promise early on. And looking back, that recognition seems incredibly prescient, doesn't it, given everything that came after?
Definitely. But maybe the most transformative period wasn't even the structured PhD work at Princeton.
Hmm.
But those years he spent kind of orbiting it, living nearby, when that, you know, high theory brain crashed headlong into the sheer energy and reality of New York City.
Oh, absolutely. That period, roughly 84 to 88, while he was still doing his grad work, that seems to have been the real crucible for him. He was living in New York City.
Right in the thick of it.
And he talks about this as the time he really discovered things. Discovered opera, discovered literature in a new way, and importantly, discovered gay culture.
And all this against a pretty intense backdrop, right?
Yeah.
The 1980s in New York, the AIDS crisis, the art scene booming.
Exactly. It was a turbulent, explosive time. And importantly, his engagement wasn't just abstract academic observation from afar.
No, he was in the trenches.
He really was. He started flexing his critical muscles right there, writing book reviews for these really vital, sometimes politically charged publications like the New York Native and the Village Voice.
We should pause on those venues, actually, because especially in the 80s, they were crucial.
Hugely significant. The New York Native was absolutely central for the queer community. It gave a platform to voices and perspectives that, frankly, mainstream criticism was often ignoring. It dealt with the immediate, often visceral reality of that era.
And the Village Voice, well, that was just the epicenter of downtown cultural critique, wasn't it?
It was the nexus. So writing for outlets like these, it forced him to do something really specific, to synthesize that high theory he was learning at Princeton with the immediate, the personal, the urgent cultural conversations happening right then.
He had to be relevant.
He had to be relevant, quick, sharp, witty, grounded in the messy reality of the city, even when he was talking about, you know, high art forms like opera. And I think this is really where you see the core of his unique voice developing.
That blend of the personal, the accessible, maybe even a bit campy perspective.
Yeah, but applied to really serious subjects, that voice was forged in that specific time and place, I think.
And then if you look at where he is now, institutionally, it almost feels like a deliberate performance piece, embodying that refusal to stay in one lane.
It really does. It's a perfect summary of his whole approach. So on one hand, you've got the very serious academic title, Distinguished Professor of English, French, and Comparative Literature at the CUNY Graduate Center. And he teaches poetry there.
A traditional, high-level, rigorous post?
Exactly. But then at the same time, he's also teaching painting over at Yale University.
Which is just wild when you think about it. He's literally being paid by two of the most prestigious universities in the world to teach two disciplines, literary studies and fine art, that are usually kept totally separate. Different departments, different buildings, sometimes different philosophies entirely.
That whole CUNY-Yale setup, it's like a living mission statement, isn't it? It just reinforces his core identity. He refuses to partition his own mind or his career.
He just flows between them.
He flows between the, you know, theoretical demands of analyzing poetry and the immediate material physical demands of making visual art. And in doing so, he kind of forces the institutions themselves to recognize the validity of this cross-disciplinary way of being. It's like the ultimate act of professional genre obliteration played out in his own job titles.
Okay, so let's get into the actual work, the output, because this is where that whole philosophy really comes alive, right? You mentioned that quote earlier from Stefania Heim in the Boston Review.
Yeah, it's such a perfect description. She said his work obliterates any vestigial divide we might hold on to between play and thought.
Obliterates. It's such a strong verb. Not just ignores the divide, but actively destroys it.
Exactly. And she also said he celebrates and broadcasts risky joys and joyful risks, which I think is key. It gives him this license somehow to explore really subjective stuff, queer experience, messy personal feelings, but using the tools, the high standards of serious academic inquiry. It's like personalized critical theory almost.
Okay, so let's dive into some specifics. Where better to start than the book that really put him on the map critically? The Queen's Throat, Opera, Homosexuality and the Mystery of Desire, came out in 1993.
Right. And the subject on the surface seems pretty straightforward, trying to understand that well-known, often intense connection between gay men and opera, especially the figure of the diva.
But the way he analyzes it is anything but straightforward.
Not at all. The book uses opera more as a lens than just a topic, you know? Mm-hmm. He digs into how opera, with all its, like, huge emotions, its repression, its spectacular way of staging suffering and desire, how all that acts as a kind of psychic space, a container for aspects of queer experience, particularly maybe the experience of being closeted. The sheer drama of opera mirrors the internal drama society sometimes forces on people.
So it goes beyond just saying, oh, gay men like opera. He found a deeper critical insight there.
He did. His conclusion was that this relationship, this affinity between gay men and divas, it tells us just as much about opera itself, about its built-in questions around performance, masculinity, spectacle, what constitutes too much emotion, as it does about homosexuality or gay identity. He's really probing those fundamental questions about how culture shapes our desires and then how our desires in turn shape how we read culture.
Like diva worship, for instance. Yeah. It's not just liking the music.
No, he frames it as more like identification. It's about watching someone perform these incredibly heightened emotions, emotions that might be forbidden or impossible to express in everyday life. And the risky joy here, I think, was the intellectual risk he took.
Oh, so?
Well, fusing that high formal analysis of opera with these intensely personal, subjective, often quite campy cultural interpretations, that combination felt pre-revolutionary back in 93. It broke rules.
Okay, let's jump forward quite a bit to 2011. He shifts gears pretty dramatically, doesn't he? Takes on this huge abstract feeling that everyone experiences, but hardly anyone dares to analyze so directly.
Yeah.
Humiliation. The book is just called Humiliation.
Yeah, it's a brilliant move. Because humiliation is maybe the ultimate subjective, intensely personal feeling, right? But Kostenbaum approaches it with that same critical rigor. He treats it like a cultural phenomenon that actually deserves scholarly attention.
How does he do that?
He manages to analyze the shame, the vulnerability, the sometimes absurdity of being humiliated. And he weaves together personal anecdotes, moments where he felt humiliated, with this broader cultural commentary about power, exposure, social dynamics.
And the reception really highlighted that unique tone he strikes, didn't it? Remember the quote from John Waters?
Oh, yeah. The filmmaker John Waters, himself a master of blending camp and critique, he called Humiliation the funniest, smartest, most heartbreaking, yet powerful book I've read in a long time.
Funny and heartbreaking about public shame. That really is Kostenbaum's sweet spot, isn't it?
It perfectly captures it. And typically, he didn't just stop with the book itself. The promotion, the way he presented it, became part of the whole analysis.
That's the web series?
Exactly. He created this online video series called Dear Wayne, I've Been Humiliated, where people could like write in with their own stories. The New York Observer called it the mother of all book trailers, which was hilarious.
That's brilliant. And it really cements that strategy you mentioned, the critical work. And the playful, multimedia way he presents it are just two sides of the same coin.
Totally. The book is the theory, you could say, and the trailer, the web series, is the performance of the theory. It's all integrated.
Okay, this seems like the perfect point to bring up the book that maybe pushed the boundaries of his delirious scholarship the furthest. The Anatomy of Harpo Marx from 2012.
Oh, boy. Yeah. Harpo Marx.
I mean, taking a silent film comedian, someone who communicates mostly with honking horns and wild physical comedy, and giving him this incredibly dense theoretical treatment, usually reserved for, I don't know, Shakespeare or Joyce.
It was bound to cause a stir, and it did. The reviews were just all over the place, completely polarized, which honestly is often a pretty good sign that Kostenbaum's hit a nerve.
So what was the positive take?
Well, you had genuine high praise. Brian Dillon, for instance, called it charming and rigorous and significantly an excellent example of a kind of delirious scholarship.
Delirious scholarship.
Oh.
That phrase just nails it, doesn't it?
It's perfect. It captures the whole method using the tools of serious academic inquiry, but applying them to subject matter that seems almost designed to induce, well, delirium or absurdity.
But then there were the critiques. And they really highlight just how far he's willing to push those theoretical limits.
Big time. Saul Austerlitz, writing for the San Francisco Chronicle, basically felt Kostenbaum sexualizes Harpo beyond all recognition.
And there was that one specific line that everyone seemed to quote?
Yes, the anus line. Austerlitz cited it. It's where Kostenbaum posits, quite seriously, that courtesy of the anus, we can imagine, Marxist style, a path away from family and state.
I mean, wow, that's the flashpoint for the whole controversy right there, isn't it?
It absolutely is. But you have to understand, that sentence, as maybe barmy as it sounds on the surface, it's a deliberate critical provocation. He's plugging into specific theoretical frameworks, psychoanalysis, queer theory. He's taking Harpo, the silent comedian who's constantly resisting normal speech, normal gender roles, normal social behavior, and reading his physical comedy, his body, as a kind of radical political text. In queer theory and psychoanalysis, the anus is often discussed as a site that resists normative reproduction, traditional family structures, state control hence, a potential path away from family and state.
So he's arguing that Harpo's silent, anarchic body embodies this theoretical concept.
And essentially, yes. He's making the argument that no subject, not even a seemingly silly, silent comedian, is too frivolous to bear the weight of really radical critical theory if you apply the right lens, or maybe the wrong lens in the most productive way.
So the apparent absurdity isn't a bug, it's a feature. It's a calculated theoretical move.
That's exactly it. And critics like Joe Queenan, even when they were clearly frustrated by it, kind of inadvertently hit on Kostenbaum's genius. Queenan wrote that Kostenbaum peppers his story with just enough tidbits of fascinating information that readers may fleetingly overlook the fact that his theories are barmy. But the barmy theories are the point. They force you, the reader, to question your own assumptions about what counts as a serious academic subject, what deserves deep theoretical attention.
Okay, beyond these really deep focus monographs, he's also produced a massive amount of work in essays, right? Covering a huge range.
Oh, absolutely. His essays tackle pretty much everything: celebrity culture, classical music, contemporary art, literature, aesthetics. His critical gaze seems restless.
And the collections themselves have these great provocative titles.
They do, like Cleavage, Essays on Sex, Stars, and Aesthetics, or My 1980s and Other Essays, and Figure It Out, Essays. These titles alone show you he sees high culture and pop culture, or even celebrity culture, as equally valid fields for serious, nuanced thinking.
He'll analyze, like, the aesthetic meaning of a celebrity's cleavage.
Yeah, or a pop star's public meltdown.
With the same kind of theoretical intensity he brings to an opera libretto or a complex poem.
Exactly. And then there are the other key nonfiction books that solidify his role as this major interpreter of modern icons. His monograph on Andy Warhol, for instance.
And that seminal book, Jackie Under My Skin. Interpreting an icon.
Yes. The Jackie book is brilliant because he doesn't treat Jackie Kennedy Onassis just as a person to be biographized. He treats her as a cultural text, a kind of screen.
Oh.
Onto which America projected all its complex desires and anxieties about things like style, money, tragedy, resilience, image itself.
So combining that work on icons with his other critical books, like Double Talk, The Erotics of Male Literary Collaboration.
Right, which looks at the intense relationships between male writers.
You just get this picture of staggering intellectual output, but with a real consistency in his approach to high-level cultural theory.
Now, while all that critical work kind of defines his public persona as this intellectual powerhouse, his poetry offers a different window. It really shows an evolution in his relationship with language itself. He moves from this, like, intense engagement with literary tradition all the way to some pretty radical experimentation later on.
And what's fascinating, connecting back to what we just discussed, is that the same person writing those barmy theories about Harpo Marx actually started his poetry career with incredible structural control.
Totally. His very first book of poems, Ode to Anna Moffo and Other Poems, named after an opera singer, naturally.
Of course.
That was mostly written in things like syllabic verse and other really fixed traditional forms. It shows that mastery of craft we talked about from his Hopkins training.
And David Baker, who reviewed that collection for Poetry Magazine, he picked up on this tension early on.
What did he say?
He noted that Kostenbaum was, quote, willing to exert the pressures of traditional formality, so he embraces the rules.
Right.
Yet he is also likely to let the voice and experience of a poem great against his own formal gestures.
Ah, that's interesting. That friction, the personal voice kind of pushing against the constraints of the form that sounds like the energy of his early work.
Exactly. And he proved he could go back to that intense rigor whenever he wanted to. His book-length poem, Model Homes.
Oh, yeah, the Ottava Rima one.
The Ottava Rima one. For anyone listening who isn't familiar, Ottava Rima is this incredibly demanding classical Italian verse form.
Yeah, 8-line stanzas, usually iambic pentameter with a really specific rhyme scheme. ABB Bay, ABCC, think epic poetry, Byron, that kind of thing.
So to write an entire book in that structure, that takes serious technical chops and stamina. It's like the ultimate proof of his foundational seriousness, isn't it?
It really is. It's like saying, look, I can do this perfectly traditional thing at the highest level, which, again, gives him more license to break the rules later.
And break them he does. The real revolution in his poetry comes later, with works where he fully embraces that riskier side, the play side of the play and thought idea. We're talking about books like The Pink Trans Notebooks and Camp Marmalade.
Right. These are pure experiments in what he himself calls trance writing.
Trance writing. What does that actually mean in practice?
Well, it seems to be the poetic equivalent of that delirious scholarship we saw with Harpo Marx. Kostenbaum describes it as a kind of automatic writing process.
Like the surrealists.
Sort of, yeah. Writing very fast, deliberately not revising, trying to bypass that internal critic or editor we all have. The aim is just to let the language pour out.
Unfiltered.
Unfiltered, yeah. Unrestricted by the usual expectations of like clear themes or logical syntax or narrative coherence.
The Paris Review had a good description saying it allows language to move freely. But mechanically, if he's writing without revision, what does that actually produce, and why is that method important to his overall philosophy?
Well, what it produces is essentially raw process. The text becomes a document of thought, emotion, aesthetic association happening in real time, unedited. It often works through sound, through leaps of association, rather than straightforward logic.
So the complete opposite of the painstaking precision needed for Ottava Rima.
Exactly. It represents maybe the total obliteration of that gap between the spontaneous impulse of the mind and the finished, polished artistic object. It values the flow over the finish.
And the books themselves even look different, right?
Yeah, they do. Publishers Weekly described the Pink Trance notebooks perfectly, saying it looks and feels like the cut and paste fragments of a journal.
So an embrace of the fragmentary, the collage, the immediate.
Precisely. The aesthetic value is found in that sense of imperfection, maybe, and the speed of thought captured on the page.
And you see this restlessness, this need to keep moving, and his shifts across narrative forms,
Yeah.
too. He hasn't just stuck to poetry and criticism.
No, not at all. He's published fiction as well. There's Moira Orfei in Ex Mortis, which later got reprinted under the title Circus, and another novel called Hotel Theory.
And then most recently, another shift again,
Right.
moving towards even shorter, more stylized, allegorical forms with his 2021 collection, The Cheerful Scapegoat, Fables.
Right. It's like this constant quest for the right container for his ideas at any given moment. As soon as he seems to have mastered one genre or pushed it to its limit, he jumps into a new one. It's relentless. Okay, so now we really cross the line, don't we? We move completely beyond analyzing culture and aesthetics through writing and into him actually creating visual art and performance pieces. This is where the theory and the philosophy get physical, get enacted.
And this move into painting, it's actually relatively recent in his long career, isn't it? It started around 2005.
That's right. And the origin story is just classic Kostenbaum. It wasn't like he just woke up one day and decided to paint. The critical thinking came first, literally.
Oh, so.
He apparently started painting right after he finished writing an essay for a museum show. The exhibition was called Contemporary Erotic Drawing, held at the Aldrich Museum.
So writing about drawing made him want to draw.
Or paint, yeah. It's as if the act of critically engaging with the subject unlocked the creative impulse in him. It made the act of making visual art feel kind of necessary, unavoidable even.
And right away, his style connected back to those themes we've seen in his writing, pop culture, celebrity, the idea of reproduction or copies.
Definitely. Ella Kuhn, writing in Art News, pointed out that his early paintings were figurative. They depicted things, people, and crucially, were explicitly influenced by Warhol.
Warhol again. So he's adopting the visual language of one of the key cultural icons he'd already analyzed so deeply in his writing.
Exactly. The critic becomes the practitioner using the master's tools.
Let's talk about his technique for a minute, because it sounds like it mirrors that immediacy we saw in the trance writing. He uses a specific monoprint technique.
Yes, the monoprint is really key to understanding the look and feel of his paintings. A monoprint basically is a single unique print. You prepare a surface, ink it, maybe draw into it, and then take just one impression onto paper. You can't make an identical second one.
Okay, so each one is unique.
Right. And Kostenbaum used this technique often to trace images of male nudes figures he'd originally drawn from life onto a dark, usually black background.
Why the monoprint, do you think? What does that process offer him?
Well, it forces that unique immediacy, that singularity. It reflects the spontaneity, maybe, of the trance writing. The image feels raw, transferred quickly, and it's one of a kind. It prioritizes that moment of creation over slow, layered revision or perfection.
And the subject matter, the male nude, captured in this raw, immediate way.
It feeds directly back into all his critical work on queer identity, desire, the body as a site of meaning or spectacle, all the stuff he explored way back in the Queen's Throat, just in a different medium now.
And we should stress, this isn't just, Professor's weekend hobby.
Yeah.
He's exhibited this work quite seriously.
Oh, absolutely. He's had solo shows at really significant contemporary art venues, places like White Columns in New York, the Art Museum at the University of Kentucky, 356 Mission in LA. The serious art world takes this work seriously. It's recognized as a valid parallel artistic practice.
And the performance side doesn't stop with visual art.
Yeah.
He also stepped into music and performance art itself. He released a record.
Yeah, his first piano and vocal record called Lounge Act. It came out in 2017 on Ugly Duckling Press Records, which is primarily a poetry press, interestingly enough.
Lounge Act. I mean, that title alone is perfect Kostenbaum, isn't it? It suggests that blend of high art, serious vocal performance, piano composition, with a kind of camp, maybe slightly faded, aesthetic, the lounge singer.
It's spot on, and this connects directly back to his lifelong critical fascination with opera, classical music, and the whole theatricality of identity and performance.
And he performs this material live.
He does. He's performed these kind of combined pieces featuring his music, maybe visual projections of his art, readings from his texts at major cutting-edge cultural institutions, places like The Kitchen in New York, Red Cat in L.A., even the Centre Pompidou in Paris, and the Walker Art Center in Minneapolis.
Wow, those are major contemporary art venues.
They really are. They validate his performance work as sophisticated, high-level contemporary art, not just a literary reading with some music tacked on.
And then, to bring it all full circle, he actually worked as a librettist for an opera.
Yes. The opera Jackie O. He wrote the words, the libretto. So he took one of those cultural icons he'd spent so much time critically interpreting and provided the text for her story to be told in that ultimate high drama, high art form he loves, opera.
It's amazing how it all connects if you try to link up all these different disciplines he works in.
Yeah, that's the real brilliance, isn't it? How cohesive the underlying vision feels, despite the incredibly disparate mediums. His critical thinking about aesthetics, about celebrity, about icons like Warhol and Jackie O, it directly fuels the subjects and even the styles of his painting and his performances.
The critic and the artist aren't separate entities.
They're locked in this constant, really productive conversation within the same person. He kind of proves through his own career that maybe the deepest way to understand something, whether it's opera or Harpo Marx's comedy or the painted nude body, is to actually get your hands dirty and participate in making it yourself.
So to really get a handle on the sheer scale of what he's done and the sustained quality of it, maybe we should quickly recap the scope of his recognition and just the volume of work we're talking about. He shows this consistent influence over decades, right?
Absolutely. The awards alone tell a story of real staying power. You've got the Guggenheim Fellowship, really prestigious, just in 2023.
Okay.
That American Academy of Arts and Letters Award in Literature in 2020 we mentioned earlier. Go back further, the Whiting Award in 94. And even earlier, the Discovery the Nation Poetry Award way back in 1989. This isn't someone who just had one big moment. It shows his challenging work has become kind of fundamental to the conversation in contemporary arts and letters.
Okay, so for you listening, if you're now intrigued and want to actually dive into reading Kostenbaum, let's try to give a quick structured overview of the key works we've touched on, maybe grouping them by the genres he loves to blur.
Good idea. So under poetry, you'd want to look at the contrast. Start with that early, rigorous, formal mastery you see in books like Ode to Anna Mofo or that incredible feat, Model Homes, the one written entirely in Ottava Reimer.
It's a traditional foundation.
Exactly. And then contrast that immediately with the radical freedom and experimentation of his trance writing books, like the Pink Trance Notebooks or Camp Marmalade. Seeing those side by side gives you the map of his poetic journey.
Okay. Then criticism. This is where you find those foundational texts that made his name as a public intellectual.
Right. The absolute must-reads are probably the ones tackling those big icons and big emotions. So, The Queen's Throat, his defining book on opera and desire. Humiliation, that brilliant analysis of a universal difficult feeling.
And the Harpo Marx book.
And yes, the controversial but totally essential theoretical firework that is The Anatomy of Harpo Marx. You have to read it, even if it makes your head spin.
Right.
And alongside those, the key texts on aesthetics and celebrity, Jackie Under My Skin, and maybe his Andy Warhol monograph. Oh, and Notes on Glaze. 18 Photographic Investigations is a fascinating later work looking at surfaces and aesthetics.
And finally, we have the works that kind of defy easy categorization.
Exactly. His specific forays into fiction, with novels like Hotel Theory or Circus, his more recent turn towards fables in The Cheerful Scapegoat, and of course, his contribution to the operatic stage as the librettist for Jackie O.
It's just an immense body of work when you lay it all out like that, spanning visual art, performance, criticism, poetry, fiction, fable. It's the collective evidence of his lifelong project of genre obliteration.
It really is. Hashtag out outro.
So after all that, what does this incredible sprawling output really mean for us? How do we synthesize Kostenbaum's legacy, his contribution?
Well, I think you could say he's maybe the preeminent example of a scholar who uses the most rigorous tools of academic criticism, drawing a lot from queer theory, psychoanalysis, literary theory, but uses them to explore these incredibly subjective, sometimes messy aspects of popular culture, celebrity, and classical art. He manages to treat huge, painful emotions like humiliation or seemingly lightweight subjects like a silent comedian with this amazing combination of spectacular wit and really profound, sometimes unsettling depth.
He basically changes the rules for what counts as serious critical thinking, doesn't he?
He fundamentally does. His whole career is like this powerful argument that the highest forms of intellectual thought often demand that you consciously embrace play, that you allow for those risky joys, that you sanction delirious
So
scholarship.
the lesson for anyone engaged in critical thinking is.
The lesson seems to be, don't be afraid to sound barmy. Don't be afraid of risking dismissal if that risk, that provocation, might lead you to a genuinely fresh, maybe even radical insight or truth.
It immediately makes you think about how relevant that method is right now.
Yeah.
I mean, if Kostenbaum used figures from the past, like Jackie O or Harpo Marx, as these really complex mirrors for the desires and anxieties of their time,
Yeah.
how should we be applying that same kind of lens to our own contemporary moment, our own culture?
That's a great question, and maybe that's the provocative thought to leave you, the listener, with. If the critical mission is partly about finding the serious hiding within the seemingly frivolous.
Finding the Marxist path away from family and state,
Yeah.
hidden inside the laughter, as he put it.
Exactly. Then what current contemporary figure, maybe a pop star, a reality TV personality, an influencer, some piece of viral media that we currently dismiss as just cultural fluff, as meaningless? What seemingly shallow thing today would actually provide the best subject for a really deep, serious, maybe even delirious Kostenbaum-style critical investigation, whose anatomy, which cultural phenomenon's anatomy, is just waiting to be written by the next generation of critics willing to take that risk.
A fantastic challenge for the critical, curious minds out there. Thank you so much for guiding us through the wonderfully complex, genre-destroying, fascinating world of Wayne Kostenbaum.
It was my pleasure, a wild ride.
It certainly was. And thank you all for listening. We'll see you on the next deep dive.